Thank you. Good morning, Council. While you're getting situated, our next case on the calendar, as I mentioned previously, is A19-0451, State of Minnesota versus Carrie Lynn. Is it Freese? Freese? Okay. Thank you. This is the second case on our oral calendar for today. Council, for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal for the attorney for appellant, if you so choose. When you approach the podium, please state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and you can adjust the podium up and down. There's a button just underneath the podium. And counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Christopher Mishick. I'm an attorney at the State Public Defender's Office, and I'm representing Carrie Freese. Your Honor, Ms. Freese was convicted and adjudicated guilty of exposing a minor to methamphetamines in violation of MnStat 152-137. A jury also found her guilty of gross misdemeanor child endangerment and felony fifth-degree drug possession. Ms. Freese requests that her child meth exposure conviction be reversed simply because her conduct did not actually expose the child to meth under the plain meaning of the word exposed, and therefore the evidence was insufficient. She's also requesting that this court conclude that the evidence was insufficient to support the guilty verdict on the child endangerment and drug possession counts. For the purposes of the argument today, I'd like to focus in on the statutory interpretation issue with the child meth exposure statute, and also look at the child endangerment sufficiency argument in my brief. So starting with the child meth exposure statute, basically when a sufficiency of the evidence claim hinges on the meaning of a word, this court looks de novo at the meaning of that word and uses the tools of statutory interpretation to understand that word, and then it applies the facts to the case and to see if the conduct matches the meaning.
So, counsel, before we jump into the statutory analysis, I think you're right. That's where we have the biggest task in front of us today. The statute that we're looking at, under which Ms. Freese was convicted, so this is subdivision 2B. So, yes. As you referred to it, child meth exposure. It does have several elements. You know, exposing the child is just one, right? And you are not challenging the other elements in the statute, right?
No, I'm
sufficiency of the evidence.
Exactly. Specifically looking at exposure because that was the theory of the state's case.
Yep.
It was discussed in pretrial motions that this case is really about the expose element.
Okay, and not about, for instance, knowingly causing or permitting.
I'm not addressing those.
You're okay, right. And that's how I read your brief. I just wanted to verify it. Thank you.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. So the tools, you know, available to this court are, this court needs to look at whether the word to be exposed, the phrase, is ambiguous or not. So to do that, courts often looked at dictionary definitions. The definition I cited in my brief was to subject or allow to subject to an action, influence, or condition. Now, there's probably two ways of looking at that. The state, I think, is looking at it more broadly, that if you're sort of in the same area as something, that you're exposed in the sense that you expose your kids to good art or books or something like that. We're asking this court to have a more limited interpretation of expose in the sense that it's something, I mean, the rule of law that I'd ask this court to adopt on what expose is that the chemical of meth somehow ended up on the child or in the child somehow.
Why? I have several questions. My first question is, are you arguing that the statute is ambiguous or unambiguous?
I'm arguing that the statute's unambiguous.
Okay.
And to do that, I'm using the dictionary definition, and then the court should also look at the whole statute Just because there's two dictionary definitions, one broader than the other, doesn't necessarily mean that it's ambiguous.
Okay, because
you can read the word in context with the other parts of the statute.
Right. So you're relying on the New American Heritage Dictionary definition?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, and there it says exposed as, quote, to subject or allow to be subjected to an action, influence, or condition. So if you're subjected to a condition, how do you get from that exposure definition to reading that to say that you actually have to have some type of physical contact? That doesn't seem to fit with that dictionary definition.
Right, and I'm not saying direct physical contact's necessary. What I'm saying is that somehow the chemical ended up, you know, on or inside the body.
But
so how does that happen?
Right,
I'd
like the court to look at really the words around exposed. So you have to inhale, to have contact with, and to ingest.
So those three seem to cover ways that somebody could have some type of contact.
Exactly.
So if you have the phrase be exposed to, wouldn't that be redundant if you've already got three other ways of which you can have contact, from airborne, from physical, to actual ingestion?
I think what I'm advocating for is something a little more broader than direct physical contact. So, for example, you could be in a room where, you know, maybe meth was smoked or was in the air, and somehow it got on you, and you couldn't actually prove how it got on you in your hair follicle or in your bloodstream, and you were exposed to that.
Okay.
That's different than reaching out and actively touching something, handling something.
But that's having contact with it.
I disagree. I think it's broader and it encompasses more than direct physical contact, such as picking up, you know, a thing of meth, having it in your hand, having it rub on your skin. That's direct physical contact. What I'm saying is you could be in a room with something and it ends up on the kid's, you know, skin or hair somehow, and you don't know how it ended up there or in their blood.
How is that different than having contact with that?
Well, I think contact is, though the way I'm reading contact is it's direct physical contact. So it's actually picking up something and handling.
But it doesn't say intentional contact. Couldn't it just be unintentional?
It could be
contact?
Unintentional, sure.
So if contact isn't limited to directly picking something or intending to touch something,
right,
then I don't, how is it not contact if you're in a room and there's smoke that makes contact with your hair or your skin? Isn't that still contact?
Well, I think it's broader than contact. What I'm arguing is you're reaching out, you're touching something touches you, that's physical contact.
But the language in the statute doesn't say have physical contact with, it just says have contact with, which
correct.
Is broader, which could, it seems like that would encompass something that's airborne,
right.
That you're not actually, like Judge Bryan said, you're not actually physically out reaching out and touching it, but it's contact, there's some type of contact. I'd agree
there's some type, I mean, the actual physical particle of methamphetamine ends up in the bloodstream or on the hair, so that, in a sense, that's contact. But I think it's broader than the phrase just contact. And I'd like the court to look at the other subparts of the statute. Now, if it was just you're in the same room, if you adopt the way that the state wants you to read it, and essentially you're just in the same room as meth and around it, and there's no physical, or there's no, you know, it's not in you or on you, then essentially you've criminalized just being in the presence of drug possession. The legislature listed out really when that's a crime. So
I'm not so sure that's true, because the first part of that statute says, quote, no person may knowingly cause or permit a child. So there is some other action that has to take place with the exposure. It's not just if we had meth in here that was used as an exhibit, trial exhibit. It happens more in district court than it would here, obviously. But the fact that there's a child in that place, that seems to be different, because here you're talking about knowingly causing or permitting a child to be exposed to a chemical or substance or paraphernalia or methamphetamine itself.
Right. Well, I think the other thing, though, that the court should look at is the child endangerment statute, That also lists out, and there's an, I think there's a knowing element of that. That also lists out when it's a crime to be in the presence of a controlled substance.
So is the issue here knowing in each of the three counts, or is the issue something different about the exposure piece?
I don't follow the question. The issue is about knowing?
Well, to follow up on what Judge Reyes was saying, the added piece to the exposure statute that makes it different from, as you put it, just being in a room with drugs is the knowing element. And so to the extent that what you're saying here is that the defendant couldn't have exposed because she didn't know, then it's essentially the same argument you're making when it comes to constructive possession and when it comes to endangerment. So that's why I'm asking, are you really asking about knowing, or are you asking or looking at how to define expose?
I'm really looking at how to define expose. I mean, something more than the child just standing there and being present in a room with methamphetamine is needed here. Because the legislature already made it a crime in other parts of these statutes, and they didn't make fifth-degree drug possession and being in the same room a crime. So I think the legislature, if you look at the totality of all this, the statutes together, intended something more than just being present. That's what I'm getting at with this. I think if this court finds that it's ambiguous, that expose is ambiguous, then it should look at all the committee hearings that I quoted in my brief. And in there, it's very clear that when they're talking about exposure, they're talking about situations where methamphetamines or methamphetamine precursor chemicals were actually in children's
right,
bloodstreams.
Right, but first of all, if we determine that the language is clear and ambiguous based on the language here and dictionary definitions, we don't need it to get into legislative history.
Right.
So that's almost a course of last resort. Second of all, those are just examples. That doesn't mean that you can't have other situations such as this one where there is methamphetamine in a purse between a bed and a wall, and you've got a child that's actually in that room and sleeping in that bed. That seems to, I mean, it seems to be a situation where you have somebody that, under the dictionary definition, is subject to a condition where there's methamphetamine right there within, apparently it looks like it might even be within arm's length of where the child is sleeping and staying.
Well, on that and looking at the facts, I disagree. I mean, the methamphetamine was inside of a Ziploc baggie, which was inside of a purse, which was then concealed behind a bed. So I don't think from that you can surmise that methamphetamine particles were drifting about or that.
Well, but that goes to your definition of expose, of having some type of contact. But that seems to be already part of the definition, which is different and distinct. I mean, we have to, another part of the statutory interpretation is looking at the language so that there's no superfluous language. And your definition of having to have some type of contact seems to be covered by a phrase already. So expose seems to be, need to be interpreted differently than having the contact with.
Well, I mean, we're going to have to agree to disagree. I think that the legislature was intending that expose meant that the particles ended up on the person or in the person. And if
you think the legislature intended for that language to mean,
I think the plain meaning of it supports that.
So
yes,
let me ask you a slightly different way. I understand the definition of expose that you're asking us to adopt as a plain meaning,
right,
without looking at legislative history. So if we were to do that, wouldn't we, and it, you know, again, unpublished decisions aren't precedential, but it seems to me your line of argument was implicitly at least rejected by a different panel of this court in the Malmo case.
Right.
Because that was also, and I think I'm not even clear it was actually meth, but it was a meth product at least in a jar, I think, hanging in a tree not far from children. So wouldn't that, had we your definition, proposed definition of expose, wouldn't that call into question our analysis in Malmo as well?
I don't think it would. I mean, I think the argument...
What's the difference between the meth in the bottle, in the jar, in Malmo, and the meth that's in the purse?
Well, because the circumstances that were proved in Malmo are completely different. They're more extreme. You know, Malmo had heavy rubber gloves on when they arrested him, and there was a child right next to him in a car seat. You know, when the police arrived, they smelled a very strong odor of methamphetamine or chemicals in the air. And I think from that, from smelling it, from the fact that they had put on these huge hazmat suits, they brought the kids down to the hospital, all of these are circumstances I think that a jury can look at or a fact finder and say, you know what, there's probably something in the air there that ended up on the child, and we can surmise that this has happened. The facts here, though, aren't the same. The drugs were in a Ziploc baggie, in a purse, hidden behind a bed, and essentially that's different than an odor going about.
Well, yes, it's definitely different. I mean, you pointed out many ways in which it's different. But this is a case, too, where we have evidence in the record that simply putting meth somewhere doesn't make it safe. So, for instance, the evidence about the owner's dog ingesting the meth. Now, I'm not trying to say that that necessarily means that the child in this case would have ingested the meth, but it's certainly out there, right? I mean, it's not safe to have meth in a room with a child, or at least that's a reasonable proposition.
Right, and I see my time's coming up, but with the situation with the dog, the way that came in was the dog was digging through the garbage, so essentially there's loose meth in garbage. Here, again, the meth is contained in two containers and then concealed. The meth was stored and concealed. So I think that makes this case different.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Plant. I work for the County of Olmsted, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this matter. I'm here today asking you to affirm the jury's convictions of Ms. Freeze for the three different counts of child endangerment, also exposure to methamphetamine, and then also the fifth-degree possession charge. First of all, with respect to the exposure to methamphetamine argument, since the court and counsel already have started there, I would draw your attention immediately to Exhibit F, which I had provided prior to the argument today, packets to each of you judges. And here, as far as the purse being stashed away or hidden where a child wouldn't find it, I wanted to make clear what it was that the jury saw with respect to is the evidence sufficient or not when we're talking about exposure. Counsel relies pretty heavily on the idea that the methamphetamine is enclosed not just in one container but in two containers. A, it's in a Ziploc baggie, and B, it's inside a purse. You can see by looking closely at Exhibit F that there was actually enough room between the mattress and the wall where the purse was quote-unquote stashed that there was an electrical cord that was able to be plugged into the socket in the wall. And looking at the type of cord it is, it looks like it's a three-prong cord. And typically, common knowledge is what the jury's operating off of. I think it's pretty common knowledge that one of those cords, as I'm showing the court right now, is at least about an inch to an inch and a half long, that it needs to stick out from the wall. So when we're talking about a 9-year-old boy sleeping on this mattress, which is one of the circumstances proved, we're talking about a 9-year-old boy who has a small hand which easily could get into that crack where the purse was stashed underneath a pillow, whatever the case may be, that we don't know for certain. The officer's testimony was that the pillow may have been obscuring the view of the purse at the time they entered the room, but it would be a reasonable inference for the jury to make the leap that the pillow was moved to cover the crack between the mattress and the wall once Ms. Freeze heard the cops barreling up the stairs to execute the search warrant. So I wanted to just draw your attention to that right away.
And just to be clear, counsel, I think you're specifically referring to the photographs on Exhibit 5E and 5F?
Yes, I'm sorry. Exhibits 5F and 5E, Judge.
And I think your comments to counsel already make it clear that we do have testimony about where the drugs were found, and that's slightly different from what we see in the photos.
That's correct.
Because at this point, what I'm looking at, the photos you provided, and thanks, they're good copies, do show the purse actually on top of the bed, which isn't where it was.
Correct, right. Correct. So the jury's hearing the officer's testimony at the time that they're also having these exhibits published to them. And he's explaining where he found the drugs, how he found the drugs, and then he also actually explains, I found them, the pillow was moved. He doesn't say it in the most articulate way, but he does explain essentially, it sounds like the pillow may have been abutting the wall and that he moved the pillow as he was conducting his search. He sees the purse. He pulls the purse outside of the crack. He doesn't walk across the room with it. He just sets it on the bed, opens it up, and finds the contents therein. The other thing I would draw the court's attention to while we're looking at the photos, it's not on 5F or 5G, so perhaps it's on E, but this is also borne out in the testimony not only from the law enforcement officers, but also from Ms. Freeze herself. It's Exhibit 5E. The purse is certainly something that a 9-year-old child might be interested in exploring. It's got a picture of a cartoon character with a heart on it. It looks very innocuous. It's not something that I particularly as a parent of a child would think would have anything illegal in it. So I don't think it's an unreasonable conclusion for the jury to look at this particular purse or item that the cops found in the room and think that it's even possible that the child found the purse and maybe started exploring it. Getting back for a moment more specifically to the issue of statutory interpretation, counsel's correct. The statute is unambiguous. The word expose means to bring someone into an area or a room in this case with something else and make that person open to the dangers, typically is the way we think of the word expose.
More specifically, counsel, do you agree that I think it's the American Heritage definition that appellant's counsel has pointed us to is a reasonable and a common definition of the word expose. To subject or allow to be subjected to an action or influence or condition.
Yes, I think that's one acceptable definition. I don't have any reason to take argument with it. I mean, I looked at that, but again, I would also say that we don't need to look at the dictionary definition to understand it because it's unambiguous. But the other piece of it, of course, is that this court said, as Judge, you already pointed out, that the Malmo case says quite explicitly and specifically, plain meaning of the term exposed does not require direct contact with methamphetamine. That cannot be any more clear. The argument of counsel is that somehow there had to be an ingestion or that there had to be an inhalation or that someone had to physically reach out and contact. That's just not borne out in the case law or in the plain meaning of this particular word. That's not how the word's ever been used in any of the case law, which I cited some of which in my brief as far as other cases in which the court has used the word exposed to mean bringing someone within the proximity of something that is likely to subject that person to harm. So the statute is unambiguous. We don't need to go into any statutory interpretation, but even if we did, the legislative intent does not exclude as far as protecting children from chemicals used to manufacture methamphetamine is not mutually exclusive to the idea that we can't also protect them from methamphetamine. And if you look at the statute,
Now I think you're comparing subdivision 2A and 2B.
That's exactly what I'm doing.
And I would like to hear your view on how we're supposed to read those together, because
right.
I think that's one of the things the court is charged with doing.
Absolutely. And that's really the point. So much of the committee notes and advisory comments and that kind of thing that counsel cited in his brief were talking about the dangers associated with methamphetamine manufacture, which of course in the early 2000s was something that was of grave concern to the community because it was a new drug. It was something that was relatively easy for people to manufacture in the home, unlike other drugs that law enforcement and others were used to and how to combat them. And so this was a completely new animal that the legislature was trying to address. And they realized in their wisdom through multiple instances of testimony as the bill made its way through the legislature that it wasn't just the final product of the drug itself that needed to be regulated and prohibited, it was also the manufacturer. So when you look at subdivision 2, it talks about the prohibited conduct. And there are two subparagraphs in that. One is that you're prohibited from exposing the child to anything having to do with methamphetamine manufacturing, and then B is explicitly addressing the final product of meth. So
A doesn't use the terminology exposed.
It does not. That was me using it in a colloquial way, Judge, and I realized it as soon as it came out of my mouth.
That's fine.
Yes, it's actually broader, I would say, than subparagraph B is, where it talks, yes, there is the knowing mens rea of engaging in any of the following activities in the presence of a child or, of course, the vulnerable adult, but it's in the residence, anywhere in a building where a child is present. Not just any building, but a structure, a conveyance, which is the Malmo fact pattern with the van. They're down by the river near the trees and the forest. They've taken their meth lab with them in any outdoor location where a child may be. So now we're even talking about they're worried about a child being exposed to the chemicals, even when they're in the great outdoors and not confined to a small space of a bedroom where we typically think of these things happening. So the legislature sweep, when they're talking about methamphetamine manufacture, is quite broad as far as the activity they want to prohibit and the proximity of the child to whatever chemicals go into making methamphetamine.
I think that you make that argument, counsel, that 2A is a broader sweep in light of, you know, we have our decision in the Mack case where we rejected the idea that mere presence of the defendant charged was sufficient to prove liability under 2A. So mere presence in a home, in that case it was a basement room in which there was a child living upstairs, and the defendant, I think mother of the child as I recall, that was not enough to convict. So there are differences between this 2A and 2B, maybe in terms of location of the meth, and of course it's meth chemicals, not meth itself in 2A, that perhaps is broader, but the culpable conduct has to be proven to be knowingly engaging.
Yes. I wasn't attempting to imply that it somehow was impermissibly overbroad, but it is broader in scope, I would suggest, or argue at least, than exposing the child to meth. So we're not, I don't think that counts. Let me rephrase that. The state's argument isn't that if methamphetamine is located in the basement of this house where there's zero evidence in the record at all that the child went, that child has been exposed to methamphetamine. That's not the argument here, and it's not the facts borne out by the record either. But the plain meaning of the word is exposed to methamphetamine, and it is not, the plain understanding of the word exposure is being near methamphetamine. That's what happened in this case. This child was found on a bed in a room where not just one portion of methamphetamine was found, but also another portion of methamphetamine was found. And Judge Bryan, to your point earlier when you were talking about ingestion or smoke being in the air and inhalation and that kind of thing, frankly, although much of the focus here has been about the purse and the drugs in the purse, the child was also exposed to methamphetamine.
Let me interject here because I think I know where you're going. You're not saying that the court can rely on the residue on the plate.
I'm not saying the court can rely on the residue on the plate as far as sufficiency of the evidence, no. But that
we don't know what that residue was. It wasn't tested.
It was NIC tested, is my recollection.
You're
in the
just
field.
Resting on the methamphetamine from the purse that was proven as methamphetamine.
I'm sorry, Judge. I didn't.
You're only resting on the methamphetamine from the purse. You're not saying that we can also look to the residue to say that was exposure.
I am saying you could also use that as an additional circumstance that was proved. My recollection from the record, and I may be mistaken here, but my recollection is that the residue from the plate was actually NIC tested in the field but was not then sent to the BCA to be verified, but that the field test that they used, and I can't recall what NIC stands for, but it's an acronym, NIK, did indicate a positive result for methamphetamine. I believe only the substance that was found in the baggie was tested by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to verify that it was in fact methamphetamine. But even still, had that been proved to be meth, which is not an unreasonable inference for the jury to get to based on all of the other circumstances that were proved, that I believe that still would count as exposure. This was methamphetamine residue that was on a glass plate that the police officer described in plain sight at about 2.5 feet off the floor. That was
Can I ask about the definition again? Because
yes.
I think, as I understand it, we're not just concerned with the word expose, because it doesn't just exist by itself. There are other words around it.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, the difference between a statute that says you can't expose a child to something and a statute that says you can't permit a child to be exposed to something.
Sure.
What do you make of the use of permit and that broader phrase? And what does that suggest about what is being prohibited in this case?
Right. Well, that goes to, obviously, some portion of the mens rea element with respect to you have to know that the methamphetamine is present in the room in order to permit the child to be exposed to it or prohibit him from being exposed to it. I didn't really focus too much or at all on that in my brief because that wasn't really the crux or I think wasn't even really alluded to at all in counsel's argument on this point. But yes, and I anticipated that question. And again, we need to focus on the fact that ultimately this is really a question of the sufficiency of the evidence. And so I do believe that you would have to know that the methamphetamine was present. And of course, appellant's testimony at trial was, no, I did not know it was there. Actually, more accurately, I think it was, that was not my methamphetamine. I don't know that we ever elicited a response from her about whether or not she knew it was there. However, we have to be deferential to the jury's findings of fact here, not the inferences that they made from those facts in a partial direct evidence case such as this one, but we still have to be deferential to their findings of fact and be deferential to the evidence that they rejected. If it was conflicting, which in this case, obviously, Ms. Freeze's testimony was conflicting evidence to that of the state's. And so the circumstances proved in this case, at a bare minimum, which I recited in my brief, and I am running out of time, so I'll be relatively quick with this, but at a minimum, the circumstances were proof that there were drugs in the room where appellant was found. Appellant was found in the room with her son. Appellant was a recovering drug addict per her testimony and per other testimony. Appellant had reason to know or knew what methamphetamine looked like. Appellant had been living in that room for at least a week with no one else in that house per her own and other people's testimony. She was the only person using that room. She never went anywhere else. She hung items in that closet where that plate was found, and she was sleeping on the bed next to where the other methamphetamine was found. My time is up. May I have leave to continue?
Yes, you may finish.
So those are the circumstances proved, as I said, in a nutshell. But given all of the, we also know that Ms. Freeze was an admitted drug user. We also know that she said she assumed there were no drugs in the house because when she was a user, she would always take her drugs with her. So her testimony is not credible, or at least the jury didn't find it was credible in light of her own testimony and all of the other facts in the record. So with respect to permitting and what that means, at least within this case, I don't believe that the record demonstrates any concern about whether or not she knew that the methamphetamine was there, again, being deferential to the jury's findings of fact in that they convicted her. And with that, I won't take up any more of the time I've already been given. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant?
Thanks. A couple of things. The legislature, they know how to make presence or proximity a crime here. They did so in subdivision 2A. They could have simply just listed meth under those subparts, and that would have been exactly what the state wanted here. They know how to do it, and they didn't do it here. So I think that 2B is a lot more narrower than mere presence, and what the state is advocating today is basically if you're in the room with a fifth-degree drug possession and that meth is theoretically accessible, then you're guilty of this crime.
If there was the bottle from Malmo ended up behind the bed?
Well, the bottle in Malmo...
Are you still making the same argument, or are you saying because... There's something different about what's in the purse versus what's in Malmo.
There is, because there was actual testimony in Malmo about the altar container that the liquid was in and how there was evaporation of the ammonia in the air and that was common and that happened frequently and that it was combustible. And so in that situation, if you had that precursor chemical behind the bed and it was leaking chemicals, of course, yes. But here we have a contained drugs in two containers. And so... The jury here doesn't have that information in front of it. They didn't bring in experts to say that, you know, how meth maybe flies in the air or is the particulates are in the air in these houses or anything. There was none of that evidence in this case. Now, turning to the plate, because I know that was brought up, the plate wasn't tested. It just wasn't. So I don't think that the state can use that now. If the state wanted to pin the plate and use that as, you know, this is meth exposure, then it should have tested the plate, and it didn't. So,
and just to clarify, you're saying that the NIC test is not enough. They needed to have the BCA test to confirm.
They did, yes. And the NIC test was never presented to the jury either. So, you know, the fact finder never determined that. You know, the jury can consider the circumstances here, but again, I just don't think there was enough evidence to show that the child was exposed under the meaning of the word. The other thing the other point I wanted to make is that these words around expose have meaning, and they limit expose. So inhale, have contact with, ingest, those limit the meaning of expose, and those are very specific words, and they all are ways that this stuff gets inside of your body. And when you're examining the word expose, you need, this court should, under the canons of construction, look at those words, and they limit expose. So
basically, if I understand you right, you're saying that because inhale, contact, and ingest include a physical element to their definition, that we should also layer that into the word expose, even though at least the dictionary definition you've given me of expose doesn't include
exactly. That's okay. Exactly my argument, and that's the nocitor socius canon that's used by courts to examine lists of words, and really that canon is so it's used to avoid ascribing a meaning of a word that's too broad that doesn't fit in with its neighboring words, and I think that's very important in this case to consider that. Trying to check if I have anything else that I want to say. Are there any more questions? I would quickly actually have a minute left, and I want to address the child endangerment. So the cases are really clear that something more than just kind of ordinary negligence is required for a conviction of child endangerment. And just because there's a possibility that the child could have found the purse and rummaged through it doesn't make it likely that it would substantially harm the child. And I'd like the court to really focus in on the words likely and substantially in that statute.
I don't think you're saying that had there been more evidence, any evidence about a child, with the effect of this amount of meth on a child, had a child ingested it? You're not saying that evidence was necessary. It obviously wasn't in the record either.
It wasn't in the record. What?
But that's not the nature of your argument, I don't think.
No, my argument is that the likelihood, I don't think it was proven beyond a reasonable doubt, the evidence was insufficient, that it was likely that the child would access the meth,
it's the likelihood of access to the meth, not whether the amount of meth would have adversely affected a child.
Right. Obviously, I think
that's the missing piece of proof.
I think it is. Yes. Thanks. My time is finished. I ask you to reverse. Thanks.
Thank you both, counsel. Very well argued and briefed. We appreciate that. We'll be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time.